New Pope, who dis?
Welcome to the officially unofficial podcast for New Pope on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Cecily. And anywhere there's a podcast, there's Bald Move. And that's who we are.
The most fragile podcasters in the world.
We're like porcelain.
We watched episode 3, titled Third Episode. What did you all think about it?
A lot of thoughts.
Yeah?
I mean,
any you care to share?
I think it's another great episode. It was the front half of it I thought was tough just because, you know, I have a kind of strained relationship with my mother. Screaming in the face of one's parent that you've achieved greatness against their every attempt to thwart you has a certain appeal to me.
Yeah.
And like a certain kind of visceral, like jacked with adrenaline. And then the back half just has so much weird, disturbing, depressing things going on with Esther that it is an interesting watch. And then throughout, then you got John Malkovich just being amazing.
Being John Malkovich.
Is it weird that I feel more comfortable in the latter half when all the weird shit is happening than I do in the beginning part? Because, like, I don't know that I fully understand Brannix.
Agreed.
And when I get to something weird, but like pretty on the face of things, I'm able to sort of settle into that a little bit more.
Yeah, the Esther stuff is weird and uncomfortable, but it's also above the board. Like, yes. It's a straight up proposition for money.
Yeah.
Whereas Brannix, like, we were having a little pre-pod discussion about, like, is he for real? Like, what is he, are the riddles he speaks in, are they like an intentional kind of verbal trap of his opponents? Is he gauging them? Or is he just having a theological discourse with his brothers?
Right.
I think probably both is happening to some degree. But again, I don't know. And it also, like, there's this also concept that Sir John's entire face that he presents to the public is one big facade that he's doing out of some weird tribute to his brother or some crazy guilt that he's feeling about the circumstance of his death, which we still don't understand. So there's a lot you could hang on his and I thought that was played too when you see the cardinals reacting to his various addresses. Like, you know, some people pleased at some of the things he's saying. He's saying a lot of things that could mean a lot of different things to a lot of people. Like, emphasis on the family is really feeding those traditional Catholics, but then talking about how we need to consider things factually and with tenderness and humility.
But not passion.
It's
truly the famous middle way.
It is the famous middle way.
Yeah,
I felt like this episode had me questioning my own questioning. I thought last episode I spent a lot of time really diving deep into the symbology of everything, when on this episode it felt like everything, or not everything, most things were a little more literal than I thought. Like the relationship between the nun and the refugee, and
God being a millipede.
That's literally just a millipede.
Where it breaks
in
down
that guy's ear.
And the nuns are giving each other prison tats in their cloister. It's there's certainly things that are happening on a metaphoric level too.
And I never know where to say okay. Drawing that line is really hard in this show. And so it always leaves me a little feeling a little strange at the end. Except when it comes to things like, oh, I understand the concept of a down on her luck woman looking for another miracle in her life. In whatever form it takes, it's a strange form, but I understand the concept.
Yeah.
Housekeeping.
A little bit of housekeeping first. HBO comes out of the gate of the new year strong with their crazy, sexy, cool series on Vatican politics, The New Pope. Episodes drop on Monday on HBO, and Jim, Cecily, and I make a new trinity of podcasters to cover all the intercourse and intrigue on Wednesdays. Search for New Pope Who Dis on your favorite podcast app or aggregator to listen and subscribe. Star Trek is back, and so far, it's really good. Will it stay the course? Find out with us as we do a deep dive on CBS All Access's Star Trek Picard on Mondays on our new Picard podcast feed. Each week, Jim and I check out a new or classic movie on the Bald Movies feed, so subscribe and you won't miss anything. This week, we'll be checking out Groundhog Day, the movie, as a kickoff for our fabulous annual Groundhog Day 24-hour charity stream. That's right. We're doing a 24-hour-long charity stream on twitch.tv/baldmove starting at noon this Friday, January 31st, with all net proceeds going to raise money for the Australian Red Cross to give relief for the bushfires that have been ravaging the continent. Make a note of the new start date. It starts this noon, this Friday, January 31st. We're running until the following noon on Saturday, February 1st. We're in the Eastern U.S. time zone, so check your schedules. But honestly, it's a 24-hour stream. It's a pretty big target to hit. We'll be watching disaster movie after disaster movie nonstop on twitch.tv/baldmove, including such classics as Twister, 2012, Armageddon, Volcano, and The Day After Tomorrow. We'll be doing a prize giveaway sometime during each film. If you want more details, follow us at baldmove on your favorite social media site, check our forums, or baldmove.com itself. Please stop by, say hi, hang out, and if you can, give to help out our friends and neighbors down under.
Can we talk about, start with Sir John, because that's kind of like John Paul the Third, as he's now known, because that's kind of what everything revolves around. I want to talk about what we know about his relationship with Adam. Up until the slap scene, we've seen nothing but them being like inseparable brothers with a very close, intimate relationship.
Twins. Can we agree they're all, both identical twins?
I think they're identical twins.
They seem like it.
Their kids didn't look so much, but the teenager young man versions of them did look identical.
Yeah.
But they're very, very similar.
I can't tell. Because we had a discussion before this about which nun is which.
We thought
they were
about
all the same nun. Some of us thought neither of them were
actually
real nuns.
I think all the nuns except
nuns,
for the abbess herself is are clones.
Yes. Yeah. So fuck me if I can tell who looks like someone else and who doesn't.
But he professes as much throughout this episode that he has been in competition with his brother, even when his brother was alive. Mm-hmm. Like, and we see it demonstrated when they're having the race to button up their
habits.
Habits. I
no,
was gonna say
nun.
Habits, but that's a nun term.
What the nun have,
Or button up their jackets, and his brother Adam beat him significantly. Like he's maybe 4 or 5, if not more, buttons behind.
Yeah.
And I feel like he's so frustrated by his brother's excellence.
And as Christ said on the Mount, blessed are the that fasten their buttons quickly. So
yeah.
Like, this is really foundational to their faith.
It's a test of faith, yeah.
It's so frustrating while he's even alive that he slaps his brother. So it's
pretty
hard
and vicious. Like it was shocking when I watched it.
Mm-hmm. It just feels like this is the kind of young man that would absolutely buy into his parents keeping him in this perpetual state of grief. Mm-hmm. For 40 years.
He feels responsible. Like so I'm saying, like, what do we know? We know that, like, from his own words, that his parents hate him for not doing enough on some fateful cold winter day. Mm-hmm. But if you live this life, and, you know, and he's screaming that, like, I have all my life, I've negated myself in a pathetic attempt to alleviate your suffering, and I've even tried to become Adam. Like, I don't think you do that unless you buy into it a little bit. And, you know, I wonder if he does feel responsible. And that's the thing. It's like, is he responsible? And, like, you know, he wasn't paying attention as a kid. Like, that's just a tragic accident. But it's also something that you would feel very, very badly about.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that they were kids, because 85 for a man of John Malkovich's age.
He's 25.
He was 25?
Yeah, we did the math last episode.
Oh, right.
Did we?
Okay. Adam and John were 25
years old. That's
not what I would label as a kid.
Yeah.
Certainly.
But were they fooling around? Was this like... But you know, the trajectory they're painting, where they're very close as children, and then they're competitive as... Could they be 25 years old in a slap scene? I thought teenagers, but then
be.
You wouldn't be wearing...
Late teens, maybe?
The full priest gear at that point, I don't think.
Probably not.
I just wonder... why and he also, like, then at Adam's grave he says that, like, all that shit he was talking to his parents was just, you know, to make them feel bad, that the whole reason that he does everything is for Adam. You know, nothing else touches him, nothing else disgusts him,
which I don't know what to buy here. Because there's clearly passion shown in those scenes, and he sort of rails against passion later in the episode when he's giving a homily. Is that what he's doing here?
Yeah, I don't know what
this
the proper
after some
word
kind
is.
Of scripture reading. I looked up what homily was.
There's an official title for the first address that the Pope makes too. It's like the Prima Popal Pontificus.
Sure. But yeah, he's kind of railing against passion. He says we need tenderness, we need love, but not passion, which is something he displayed earlier in the episode. So I do get the feeling that there are multiple sides of this man, which he's sort of at war with within himself. Mm-hmm. And he does not show to anyone, really.
And Lenny comes to him in a vision as he's having this kind of like Garden of Gethsemane moment, weeping and full of self-recrimination at Adam's grave, where, you know, Lenny explains his view that like God doesn't just hand out love like some kind of teenager. You have to earn it with him step by step. You have to grow. And it seems like that growth is tied to the silver box.
It seems very similar. Yes. That speech that Lenny gives him at the grave was very similar to Lenny's first homily, where he demands that everyone has to earn God's love.
Mm.
So, like in this, and towards the end, when John Paul III addresses all of the cardinals for the first time, you can see that he's metabolized Lenny's lessons and the things that Gutierrez has said. And he's making it his own, and he's teaching a very valuable lesson. So I feel like that makes a good pope.
Trying to learn and grow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think even some of his speech to the public was sort of around that idea, right? Like, mm-hmm. of learning and growing. Like, they need to be love, they need to be truth, but I think part of that is finding that truth.
I want to talk about kind of like Sir John in more broader terms. We learn a lot about him, that he has a relationship with Meghan Merkel.
Meghan Merkel.
Which
is already a dated reference, because they've moved out of the
it's almost more timely than ever. Yeah. It's strange how that
worked like,
out.
It's like, your best bishop buddy moves away, and like, you know, fuck England, let's go to America or whatever.
Canada.
Just live on Instagram. Can we live on Instagram? Yeah. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty funny.
yeah.
It's so funny because like a lot of I was looking at coverage of this, and a lot of people are obsessed with this. They're trying to turn this into a fucking puzzle box show, literally. Like, if you are burning with questions on what is in that silver box, please calm down. This is not what this like. It's not going to be Gwyneth Paltrow's fucking head. It's going to be some sort of medicine.
It'd be nice.
It's going to be probably heroin or something like that. You know, like, come on.
Probably
this is not
something
Westworld.
To alter his state of being.
It's going
to
be a red marble that's got Anthony Hopkins' personality downloaded on it. No, it's not going to.
Right. I think it's more.
It's
going to
glow. He's going to open it up and he's going to glow.
Yeah. I think it's less like a mystery for the audience and more something that's a temptation for John Paul.
Yes.
I'm going to start calling him John Paul. Yeah, absolutely. JP3. Something that he's trying to resist.
He also has a theater in his home, and he likes to watch Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned that his fave celebs are Dennis Hopper, Jack Nicholson, Sean Penn, and Sharon Stone, and he admires their freeness.
And Marilyn Manson. You forgot to mention Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
I thought I mentioned him off the... okay.
You might have. There's a great moment in here, though, where... Sophia does the basic instinct thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In her, it's Sharon Stone is who stars in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh man, I wonder if they actually cut her hair just for that effect too.
They might have.
But they also, first of all, I want to say is which, if any of these celebrities are going to make an appearance this season?
Well, I know Marilyn Manson is.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know for a fact, if you go on IMDb, the screenshot for episode 4 is Marilyn Manson.
And I already know Sharon Stone is too. With that same logic, they've done a bunch of promotional photos of Marilyn Manson, Sharon Stone, and John Malkovich together.
Spoilers. It's
already out.
That's
in
fun.
The UK. So
I wonder if we'll have. Yeah. It'd be funny if he brought John Malkovich to meet John Paul III.
Wow.
Although he doesn't think much of John Malkovich.
He doesn't.
Weren't we just talking about this, like in terms of the Julia Roberts? Are they going to do
exactly?
I thought we had this conversation last week about whether they'd break the fourth wall that way. And sure enough, they fucking did it.
Yep.
Absolutely did. When she was gearing up to say my favorite celebrity, you know, we're all yelling it out. Oh, John Malkovich. And then she says it and I about lost it.
Mm-hmm.
From like here to the end of the episode where my heart just starts racing.
They also start flirting with the idea of John Paul's sexuality. he seemingly flirted with both Sophia and Gutierrez. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He rebuffed.
He's writing 36 page letters to Asente.
To Asente.
And they have that moment where, you know, Asente goes up to him and asks, "Do you recognize me?" And he's like, "Oh, yes. And I haven't changed." And
yeah,
there's a little.
But it rebuffs everyone's advances.
Yeah, yeah.
And which I think that this is going to be him kind of in a Linney-esque way, replacing love and passion with tenderness. But it's going to be something mm-hmm. like this. I don't think heroin is going to, or the silver box is going to be the only temptation that lies for him in Rome, it seems like.
Yeah.
Wait, who are you referring to when you said that he isn't comes up and Asente? Says, "Do you recognize me?"
Isn't
at
it
the end?
Asente?
No, that's the guy who said he had information about him in the underground bunker.
Oh, yes. He's the priest that has that knows says, his deep secret that...
Apparently, I don't know faces or names. So, yeah.
Stuff shots. Okay.
Yeah, disregard every name or scene I think I saw.
All Italians look the same to you, Jim.
They do.
Is,
I'm
it's
an,
just weird.
I'm a racist, yeah.
It's weird. You hate your
bias.
Own race. But I think it's interesting how they're flirting with the idea of him being like bisexual or pansexual, but also
ultimately
denying himself.
Yeah, anyone could be anything, and it doesn't matter when you take a vow of celibacy, right?
Well, but that's the thing is like there's buku evidence that the vow of celibacy is not really worth mm-hmm. the paper that it's written on. I don't know if the words that are spoken aloud are because,
for sure when you've like, got they're like even... people within the Catholic Church molesting children, then yeah, it doesn't.
Well, not just that, but I feel like they very clearly there's like signs that the priests are getting down on each other mm-hmm. in the Vatican.
Yeah,
like there's
sure.
definitely some, you know, glances and waves, and it has to be all on the down low because you're
right. But I think that's the key though. It's all, you know, under the table. It's not like it's happening in the open. So in the open, none of that stuff matters, right?
Right.
And especially, I think, once you become the Pope. I don't know that we've seen a Pope do any of that stuff. I don't know about Popes through history, but like
there's Popes fucking for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's how can you resist?
Yeah. Well, but, I mean, you're either Jude Law or you're John Malkovich.
Or you're Gutierrez, who did resist in the last episode.
True.
Yeah, but that's an old
It was also interesting, like, you know, Gutierrez shutting the door literally in Asente's face, and yet he's very open to being friends with the Pope, and Asente is just watching the whole thing
in the rain
with the umbrella. It's
the light shining on his face. Yeah,
yeah. It's the pathos in there is pretty amazing. There's something I want to ask you related to the personality discussion. Is I thought that Sir John and Father Gutierrez were very simpatico last episode. It seems like of all the cardinals, Sir John was most taken with like Gutierrez's view of love and his ability to like share, you know, think something that he's like ashamed of, and but also like kind of defiant about. But I thought they had a terror attack in an African church. And the cardinals are all discussing it, and Gutierrez is discussing it with Sir John, and he just admits it. It's like, I'm bombastic, but I don't really care. Mm-hmm. This is too far away. I don't know any of these people. They don't really give any commentary about that. I felt like him and Gutierrez were kind of on the rocks at the beginning. It's just the whole affect of that their performance, and it instantly went away as soon as Sir John says, "Hey, I want you to be my friend in Rome." What do you guys make of that? Am I reading that wrong? Because I thought there was some friction there, but I felt like there was a scene missing between love is a intangible abstract concept and John Paul or the third and maybe not caring about a massacre in Africa. Am I off on that or what?
Well, this is where this is the exact scene that I mentioned, or that I was thinking of when I mentioned earlier that I have no fucking idea how to read John Brannix, and that maybe I should take him more literally, because I thought this was some kind of test toward Gutierrez to see where he stood on the thing. And so you present, you know, a pretty vulgar opinion, a vulgar viewpoint, which is, I don't give a shit about these people.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see how Gutierrez responds to that. But it doesn't seem that that's what he's doing by the end of the episode. It seems more that he genuinely, he's speaking his mind there
mm-hmm.
and just you know, whether Gutierrez is going to respond negatively or positively, it doesn't matter to him.
Is it a possibly a more subtle Gaydar check? Like the way Jude Law did or Pope Pius last year, he called Asante in and just straight up asked the first question, are you a homosexual? And then as soon as he says yes, he's just like just hammering his like call button for his assistant nun to come and get this guy removed from his presence. Like, is it?
I thought it was more like him checking other people and checking himself. Like Gutierrez is someone who he's already established that he respects his opinion on, because he's going to speak the truth to him about what the papacy actually means. Mm-hmm. And for him to say, you know, I don't really care. Gutierrez kind of agrees that it's very far away. Are you capable of caring about someone that's outside of this estate, for instance, or something that's outside of fashion or movies? And he's saying that, you know, there's a way to do that. Maybe you can be a socialite, but so was Jesus at the Last Supper. And I think that is a way for him to, again, like the things that Gutierrez said in the last episode, he worked into his address to the cardinals at the end of the episode. Yeah, I think this is another way for him to just check himself. Like, what is this? I respect this person. How do they view the world? Now, how can I make that work for myself?
Yeah, the learning and growing thing. I think that's where I'm kind of coming at with on Brannix now, is like he is making a genuine attempt to learn and grow both himself and the church. And I think that could be the difference between the popes, mm-hmm. because, you know, Pius the 13th and Francis were both like, you know, they took different approaches, but they had roughly the same extremes, right? They were both very much about changing the church in that specific way. It seems like Brannix might be more about discovering what the church should be kind of as he goes, not sort of like forcing his preconceived notion of a church.
Because that learning...
Yeah, he's a little bit more flexible, and the other two were just very hard lines.
Yeah.
Well, plus I think he's like open to what the diagnosis of the church is, mm-hmm. like he said exactly. in the previous episode. Like, he needs to learn what that is, and he's giving a very measured public statements about that, you know, mm-hmm. that people can't really argue with while he... But I don't know, because I could... you know, Lenny was Pope Pius was trying to like eliminate things. Like he's like, well, you know, you've got these priests and they're taking advantage of young men and little boys. You know what? We just need to get all the homosexuals out of the church. I think
wrong target.
Right.
General goal.
And I think Asante and some of the priests of his, you know, that are gay priests are hoping to like maybe go like accepting homosexuals, maybe allowing priests to marry, so they can like stop living in shame. I think that Brannix's middle way is going to be probably, oh, gay priests can be priests, but we're taking a celibacy shit fucking serious.
Could be.
All right.
Yeah.
Like, that's the middle press. Like, hey, gays are welcome to serve in a seminary, but you just got to stop having gay or straight sex. And that's not exactly, I think, what Asante or a lot of these priests would want. Can we talk about Violo and his unimaginable powers of persuasion? Do we take him at his face value that Hernandez is mired in sexual scandal and that he did his level best to hide all of the sexual abuse in his diocese?
Yes.
Because if so, this does kind of make Violo a little bit, it's less a personal, I want to be Pope and fuck that guy, and more like, I ain't gonna let a guy covered that's rotted to the core attain the papacy.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking. Like, he's one of the people who wields power effectively, if not selfishly. Where both things can be true. Mm-hmm. I think that he was angling towards being the Pope in the beginning. I think he's got his own secrets, obviously, that he's hiding, but they're not as bad as anyone else's. And it makes me wonder if Tommaso Valletti. Is that the Pope Francis, the second, yeah. The third that just died? How much he shared with Violo? Mm. How much time did Violo ever spend, you know, in the confessional? What does he know? Mm. He knows a lot. And it seems like he's always been a force of good so far.
It's also interesting that having them as these this polar opposites, that you've got the man of porcelain who's without sin versus the man of steel laden with sin by his own omission.
I always go back to like, you know, the idea that like if you have to say that you're the man of steel, are you really the man of steel? Like that. How much do I believe that Voiello is this man of steel? He's certainly shown a fair bit of backbone in the face of adversity via Lenny.
Yeah.
Via this whole Pope fiasco now.
Give the man credit where it's due. His scheme this episode worked. And I like how they portrayed it as if, because I'm like, oh man, this is going to be some fucking cool Littlefinger shit. But it's essentially the oldest trick in the book. Like,
right.
Yeah, we got somebody. We got even a better Pope. Don't worry about it. Don't even bother showing up to vote. It's not even going to be an issue.
Yeah, it's reverse psychology.
And we won't miss you at all.
And then he turns on his heel to walk out, and you can see in his face, like, oh, he's not falling for it. Maybe I should slow down. Or if I slow down too much, then it's going to...
Yeah.
And, like, there's this, like, really kind of almost comic tension until he's like, oh, I just have a curiosity. And then he knows the hook is...
Okay, so... What is the thing that about Norman nobility that upsets John Brennick? Because I don't know anything about
that. I don't want to set myself up as an expert.
Okay.
But I did recognize, you know, because I used to play, what was that thing? There was a game for the Commodore called like Romancing the Kingdom or something like that, where you were like, you're essentially an Anglo-Saxon king during the time of the conquest of William the Conqueror, who were the Normans. And this is like the start of the deep-seated enmity between England and France, the Anglo-Saxons versus the Anglo-Normans, and the Anglo-Saxons being butthurt at being conquered by them in the 11th century. And if you know anything about the continental Europe, it's been, you know, France and England at war with each other right up until like World War One or thereabouts. So I think this is just like these guys can probably trace their bloodlines back to these times. It's just like Franco-Norman guy sitting in the on the in as the Pope of Rome. Fuck that, nah. It's like that. Yeah, it's like this old prejudice. He's this old money, old class prejudice that he's pushing,
which is indicative of Voiello's kind of calculations too. That he knew exactly the kind of buttons to press. He understood that with their meeting in the hallway the very first time, that he needed to court Brannick's and he needed to do it well, and he did.
Yeah, yeah. So I thought that was kind of interesting. What I thought was really funny is the good laugh they all had at the deception.
Yeah.
You rascal.
Yeah. He figured it out. But he
before
figured
he went
it
to
out,
bed that night.
Yeah, the night of or the morning of.
Uh-huh. And he's like, oh, what a rascal you are. And they're all just laughing.
And then he goes along
it,
with it.
He
changed his mind is what he did. He gave him the space to sort of think about it a little bit more.
Right.
And that. He let him convince himself that he needed to do
his
this.
His vanity led him into kind of like, well, I'm not going to let some fucking Norman guy do it. But
Who will I get if it's not me? You know,
his mind was made up. He already made the speech to his parents. Yeah. You can't just stay now. So it was like a game, recognize game kind of.
I don't know. That would be like, what do you do to fuck your parents over harder? Like, you drop the fact that like you think God hates me. Well, I'm going to be Pope, so put that in your Pope and smoke it, and then then the day later when they're kind of processing that, you know what, I turned it down. I had this birthright and destiny, and I spat on it. Like, was he thinking like this is the only thing he can do to he was secretly hoping they would just have massive heart attacks as he's giving his fire and brimstone
and then you flip it
to them
again.
So can we leave England and go to Rome and talk about John Brannick's tenure as Pope so far?
Okay.
He wins the vote nearly unanimously. Mm-hmm. There was a single vote for Lenny, which is the existing, I guess, still alive Pope Pius XIII.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's obvious that John Brannick is the one that casts that vote.
I think so too.
Probably.
Yeah. It's in poor taste, but I think it's a respect thing because
I know Voiello was voting for himself in the first round.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
For sure.
He was.
Yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if he cast another one for his mole. It just seems only fair. But I thought that, his speech to the public where he says, you know, you think I'm a fragile man with a beard, and that's what I am, but you also think I know everything, and that's not who I am. It's not what I know. And he says that, you know, there's a beauty and strength in a family, which is playing probably well to the traditional Catholic base. But he also says, if we can't see the beauty in something, then the truth has been hidden, which I think, you know, there's a way to read that to say is like, if you can't recognize the beauty of like a gay marriage, you know, and let a gay marriage welcome children into their home, then it's because you don't know the truth and we need to uncover it. We need to place it on the kitchen table, something that we can talk about and fight about and we'll grow stronger. I think that's what he's going for, because he also follows it up with that we have to strive to eliminate prejudice.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably going to go into like the refugee crisis and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then protecting fragility. So he also calls himself Pope John Paul III, which is interesting because John Paul I is that pope that died within 30 days of being elected back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And there's like, I did a little bit of, you know, light reading. There's tons of conspiracy theories about, you know, why he died or if he was rubbed out or whatever. John Paul II, of course, is the pope that we knew for most of our lives, who died in, like, what, 2005 and was replaced by Pope Palpatine. And now we've got the current guy.
Is that really his name?
No, but it really is who it's who he is. So I wonder, John Paul II was known as being very, I guess, would you say socially conservative? He was like very anti-abortion, very anti-homosexual recognition in the church, but he was very fiscally liberal.
Okay.
He very much was like debt
driving
relief,
Bentleys.
Like forget for no, I mean like, the other way. Like get oh, like okay. Like we should forgive Africa of its debt. We should give to the poor. We should take care of the poor. Okay. You know, that
so more
kind
like
of.
Francis the Second.
So I wonder if like Pope John Paul III to me is a willingness to tackle the scandal of Francis II head on, because like taking that name means something in the context, because the previous episode, that was one of the questions, like, what does Francis II have in common with John Paul I? But also signals maybe a little embracing of that fiscal package that Francis is trying to push.
Hmm.
But maybe at the and maybe a middle way in the morality where it's getting like, hey, we'll embrace a homosexual priest, but they just have to take the, you know, they have to replace their love with tenderness, apparently. Because we're taking the I don't know. Those are the things I was thinking just with the playing the name game there.
Yeah. It's interesting. I thought it was interesting mostly that John Paul replaced his mic stand and podium with an actual man just holding his microphone to his face.
That was weird.
Yeah. And then his address to the Cardinals is a lot of humility and like love and tenderness, but also some firm, like, I am the Father. I will be obeyed.
Yeah.
And you'll either replace this. So he talked, and that's why I think he's going with this new understanding of homosexual. I feel like homosexual is such a fuddy-duddy word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like gay priest. Okay, let's try to say that. Gay priest is that he's saying, you know, the problem with love is this abstraction, and we allow ourselves to be overcome by our passions, that love turns to something hard, concrete, that hurts people. And he's like, you're going to have to replace that concrete love with tenderness, or else I'm going to have to replace you. I don't know if Asante took that as a threat, but if I was a gay priest, I guess I would see that as like being put on notice that like.
No, I thought it was more like if you're a priest that takes advantage of people, that you're put on notice. I think people like Asante and Gutierrez, who he really got this message from, aren't put on notice, but they're the kind of people who understand exactly what the job is. It's, you know, all of this love without passion.
Well, I mean, I'm just taking the man at his word that he thinks passion is what corrupts love. And, you know, if you have two priests having consensual sex relationship, I'm guessing that involves passion.
Sure.
And yeah, you got to guard. He's saying you got to replace that with tenderness, which is.
Well, so much of this strikes me as just him struggling with his own internal feelings, because like.
Sure.
That passion is something that, you know, has been seething under the surface
and is right
his
there.
Entire life.
Yeah.
And then it lashes out at his parents this episode. And you look at all the things that he's proclaiming they need, and it's all things that he's never had, like family, love, truth to a degree. I don't know. Mm. He's always been in search of those things.
Uh-huh.
And now that he has the power to sort of get everyone on board with those things, he's using it, he's wielding it. So like, I look at this as him struggling to understand how he's going to be Pope and how he can sort of eliminate his worst tendencies from this papacy. But I don't know. It's still very much
because we had like internal like dialogue with what Lenny was thinking because he had his mother figure there.
Right. Yeah.
The only time we've actually seen him give an internal, the closest thing to internal dialogue is when he's screaming at his parents and he's weeping at his brother's grave. Like, mm-hmm. I wonder how they'll, or if maybe this new Pope will be a little bit more of an opaque figure to us as the viewers, or if they'll find the way to have him have that kind of, you know, relationship where he can talk about like what he's actually trying to do.
Yeah. I can see maybe Gutierrez being a window into that since they've seemingly formed some kind of bond.
Sure. There may be a new because it'll have to be a new papal confessor or confessor for the I forget what they call it's a collection Curia. Of cardinals. The Curio. There'll have to be a new curial confessor, so maybe that will be a new role.
Get Cavallo in there. Just put him in there and let everyone confess to him. He won't wield that power irresponsibly.
No. What else we want to talk about? There's a couple other topics. There's Esther. There's the new nun resistance.
Yeah, let's talk about the nuns. Speaking of Cavallo, that motherfucker.
So we knew that there's a nun that's her mother's dying, and there's a dying wish for them to go and have. I forget where they're actually going.
Don't remember either.
So they're wanting to take this last vacation, mother and daughter, and they need 290 euros, and these sisters scrape all the money they got together.
Which equals out to about like $300 US dollars.
It's a pretty frugal.
So it's about the same. Yeah.
It's not much.
It's a pretty cheap make-a-wish kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they take it to this guy who is the, I forget his name, but he's the one that's...
Cavallo.
Cavallo, yeah. He's the one that's the expert at making you feel uncomfortable. And he's like, of course, like, oh, you know, of course, absolutely, this is a matter of the highest importance, but we're in a budget pinch. And I love how the nun gets got like, oh, why is Cardinal so-and-so driving a fucking Bentley?
Mm-hmm. And just got a new one.
And this guy reminds me so much of some of the, like, the JW higher-ups. I admit, like, the word, like, they're very shameless. They will pervert a scriptural principle and hypocrisy, but never that the facade of the kind, long suffering shepherd never drops as they're fucking you.
Yeah, I mean, he gets on the phone during this meeting and invites someone to dinner and this play right in front of them. With like, the yes, fuck you, you're not getting the money.
He's going to buy them off at the tickets.
I'll use 290 euros to wipe my ass.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure where it's coming from. Why he's got this hostility towards these cloistered nuns?
I just think they don't think these sisters have any power. They're like, what are they going to do? Like leave en masse? They're gonna divorce Jesus and take to the streets. And I think that might actually be what's going to happen because they're now tatting each other with prison tats of nuns fist raised and resistance.
They're getting their breasts fondled by refugees.
If he
can look into this room, if he had a camera in this barracks of
every
the nuns,
night, it's raving for Jesus.
They're raving. They're dancing around. They're smoking cigarettes. Like,
yeah,
shit's gone wrong in your nunnery, man.
Yeah,
you don't even know.
Well, the fish rots from the head, they say, and this guy is a rotten fish head.
He sure is.
And it makes it seem like there's a moment where Cavallo goes to Boiello and he says, "What news?" Well, he got news that whatever cardinal is driving a Bentley. That's news to Boiello and Cavallo. And he says, "Like, am I going to?" Is there any other news? And he says, "No, nothing." So you think the Boiello is just being kept out of the loop about the nun's plate? Mm-hmm. But then later, when they yell for Boiello, they break past Cavallo and they're just yelling during this procession. Boiello turns his back too, so it's like he didn't tell Boiello because maybe Boiello just doesn't care, and that's where you get conflicted about what does Boiello actually a force for good at all.
He's a complicated man, and his mission to serve the church I think is probably at odds in the church's own mission. But like I think he sees he's the guy that gets his hands dirty so that the church doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. He also could be because I was thinking that like when he came up and said, oh, yeah, so Cardinal so-and-so got a Bentley. It's like, and this is causing. I thought that he's going to be like, and this is kind of causing some problems with us and the nuns. Like, but nah, just not even bringing it up. Mm-hmm. Nope. Not even bringing it up. And I don't know, like Viello might have just, he's very much a man of decorum. So like just the nuns calling out for him on the way to the curio is kind of like, hey, no, no.
Could be.
So I don't know. I'm not ready to say he's, because I remember thinking he was like the fucking most evil person in the world until like halfway through the season last year, and you got to know about his relationship with Guillermo, and it seemed, yeah, I'm very imprecise on how to pronounce that or exact letters are in that guy.
There's
that,
some R's, some L's, a G somewhere in there.
And then this guy's pronouncing it, so that's not much help. But he had some kind of genuine, I felt like, moments of humility and grace to him, but he's also the guy he'll kill you and get things done.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that brings us to the topic of Esther. So I wondered, I think I forgot to ask, but I was like, who is this guy who has got the long blonde hair and he's very lanky and he's kind of hanging around playing with this kid in the last episode? And then we found a lot about him. My question is, is this priest a pimp? Did he set all this up in motion?
After like the second watch, I think that's absolutely the case.
Because he's grooming her the whole time.
Right. From the very beginning when I didn't write down this guy's name, if we ever got it, this priest that she's living under in whatever house she's staying in. Mm-hmm. This guy comes to her and says, well, you're being kicked out and you need another miracle, and puts his hand on her thigh. And then later, when we first meet Fabiano, he's talking to some other women and he says, oh, I know this guy. We used to go to seminary together before he dropped out. So they have this pre-existing relationship. Women are obviously drawn to Fabiano, and Fabiano has this relationship with this old lawyer who I think has most likely paid him for sex in the past. And that seems like everything was manufactured here to get her
especially
in this position.
Even the maneuverings that he did to put pressure on her so she's this desperate. Like, he had complete control over that.
Right.
Like, you know, he's like, oh yeah, the tenant just wants his building back. I don't know, you know. I wonder if like they have been engineering this to make this happen. I don't know why you would do something like that, but you know, because that's the thing. Like, I think Esther is an interesting person because she's talking about, well, prostitution is a sin, but she also had premarital sex with this guy. Which, I mean, I don't know how the Catholics view it, but I know they have like, there's like venial sins, which are like, you know, things that are bad but like are not going to get you in hell, and then there's mortal sins, and that's the stuff that like, nah, God will throw you in hell for. I think premarital sex and prostitution is all in the mortal category. So I thought it was interesting that she's drawn distinctions between like sins she's comfortable with. Now, I mean, personal distaste to having sex for money for a disabled man is, you know, everyone's got room for that. But I'm talking just from a purely Roman Catholic doctrinal
standpoint.
She's
certainly not the first Catholic to have sex out of marriage.
Sure.
Outside of marriage.
Or for money.
Yeah. It seems like it's what you are willing to understand in your heart is your intention.
Uh-huh.
I think, if I'm going to have this charitable kind of view, that she thought that this was another single father, just like she's a single mother, and that maybe they could hope to establish some sort of family unit. And she asked them to move in at the end of the episode, or where she's, after they've already slept together and she's desperate and looking for a place to go, she wants to live with him. Maybe that's how she can justify this in her mind is not a sin.
This guy also is so, there's also this hint of like, does he look like a poor man's version of Jude Law? Like, is there like a little passing kind of gone to see? No, not at all. Because like when he's naked and prancing around in his white underwear, she's like, have you ever thought about shaving? I'm trying to think, is she trying to make him look more like Lenny?
I picked up that immediately. I didn't pick up any resemblance to Jude Law.
Yeah, he's got the blonde hair, the dyed blonde hair. So
and
that's a start.
He's nowhere near as charming. He's got an off-putting manner that's kind of like everything's just slightly off.
I feel like that might be an Italian guy working in English. But
yeah, that's true.
I'm not sure.
But yeah, you know, he's obviously dripping with sleaze, which we can tell by the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think there's this moment after what happens, or while it's happening, when he's sitting there smoking a cigarette and the lawyer lady's got her hand on his shoulders. And it just seems so
it's gross.
Ominous. and creepy.
Also, it's the balloon popping over Esther's head when they first meet.
Perfect.
Is very interesting.
I hope it happened just naturally, but
and there's a whole the deliberate contrast between the nun opening her habit, I guess that's her slip,
her night
and,
habit,
and letting this Faisal kid fondle her. And then that kid has a crisis of conscience or awkwardness or fear, and he runs off with this similar thing happened with Esther and this kid that's got some kind of physical and I think the real problem is the mental. Like he also seems like there's some kind of mental disconnect there too. Mm-hmm. And Esther feels really creeped out and weird because also very, very poor man's version of Jude Law and the older lawyer lady didn't do anything to make this comfortable. It wasn't like, oh, hey, let me introduce you guys and then, you know.
Or let me show you a photo in advance so you can prepare yourself. Or let me give you some kind of understanding about what's going to happen. Or, hey, if you change your mind halfway through, then it's going to really fuck up things for this guy even worse than they already are. So, like, be really sure. I just want you to be and comfortable.
Does Italy not have, like, because I know in America, this isn't, like, a common thing, but there's, like, these sexual surrogates who do this as, like, a therapeutic thing. They will have sexual relations with people that are disabled or have some kind of disability. Yeah. It makes it hard for them to date because sex is a human need. But I don't know. It's like, why, if they have something like that, like, why do you need, why do you need to find a good Catholic girl to have sex with your boy for $20,000 a pop?
And also, like, he's only 20 years old and he's ever been with a woman. It doesn't seem like that desperate of a situation yet.
I don't know what's from desperate, but like, it's certainly a pitiable state, but like, why this way to get this need met? There's gotta be plenty of professional women in Italy that would probably do this, you know. It's such a weird, indecent proposal kind of thing that comes out of nowhere.
Especially with a woman who's also known pretty much for selling stories to newspapers to make a living.
Well, this might
that's
be...
what I'm saying. There's some kind of fetishization of this thing that's going on.
If
you're
you're hypothesizing that there is some grand conspiracy here to get Esther into that room.
Yes.
What if it's also not just about Esther, but it's about Fabiano and it's about this lawyer, and that moment where she puts her hand on his shoulder is more about the payment that he's going to have to make as well. Like, is there something else going on here? And I don't mean to like puzzle box this whole scenario, but like, that is a very evocative moment, and it evokes some idea of like Fabiano. Something is weighing on Fabiano, and I don't think it's just bringing this woman in to do this deed that he might consider less than flattering. But like, maybe there's something on his end, because you're right, 20 grand to sleep with your kid is a lot more than I'm sure some people would be willing to do it for, right? Mm-hmm. So if there's something else on the back end of this,
and then
make
there's
more sense.
Then there's Lenny weeping as this is all going on. I thought that's you know, shortest verse in the Bible is Jesus wept. Now we got the Lenny wept. I thought that's interesting. Also, Faisal and Viello meet.
Yeah.
And Viello's like, who are you? And he's like, I'm Faisal. And he's just kind of like, oh. And he turns away and doesn't like that. What's up with that?
I think that seems just to let us know that Viello knows now. That there's someone on the grounds. And what he'll do with that information, we'll see. But
Yeah. He starts hopping around with pockets and ears, then I'm going to start really worrying for old Faisal. Yeah. There's a couple things that I got a couple of miscellaneous points to talk about the episode.
We
got
to end this podcast right now. We have to end this podcast right now. I have to see the sunset.
Well, only if I get to tap your head with a silver hammer.
Okay. We can work that out.
Was that an uncomfortable sound for anyone else but me?
What?
Like the sound of that hammer echoing off that old man's bone dome was... like nails on a chalkboard sound that I didn't even know existed.
Huh. No, not really.
I thought I wondered if they would do that because I was doing some research about, of course, last week I also saw that like on the next on that we saw Pope getting hit with a hammer. I'm like, oh God, are they going to pronounce Lenny dead? No, you were right about it being the old Pope, but I guess this is
that.
Oh, you're the one who said that? I'm sorry. I thought that this was, it was cool because I guess this is something that they do. It's like one of their little rituals is they go and they tap on the head three times. I also, as I was watching, I'm like, is this where the Frère Jacques stuff came from? Are you sleeping? Are you sleeping, Brother John? Like, is this
maybe?
Like a dead, they're trying? Is this the ritual of the wake a dead pope? And they're like,
I know that Ring Around the Rosie was about the Black Plague, so I believe it.
Yeah, like there's a lot of these like, you know, sing-songy
London Bridge
nursery rhymes. That London Bridge was a fucking disaster.
Yeah. They got some fucked up nursery songs.
Yeah, that's what the kids are, you know, when your infant mortality rate's like 50% and most people don't make it past into the teenage years, then I guess kids are a little bit more morbid. But I like seeing some of those interesting rituals. And I read in Moore's like there's a whole complex thing, like they after they do that, they destroy the Pope's signet ring with that same silver hammer. They seal the Pope's apartment.
Wait, they destroy a ring with a silver hammer?
Yeah, each Pope has this fisherman's ring custom cast for them.
What's it made out of?
Silver, I think.
The hammer?
No, if you bash a silver ring with that silver hammer, and
what
they're trying to do is deface
because
it's a signet ring. It's something you could theoretically stamp with. And the idea is you deface that so that no one can like make a fake papal order until you get a new pope in place. And they also seal up their apartment. There's this whole procedure that like as soon as he taps him on the head three times, if he gets no response, he falls to his knees and immediately recites Psalms 130. And there's this whole process that they do.
Do they reopen the apartments ever?
The new pope gets they don't have a separate apartment for every pope.
I was wondering if there's just like a whole bunch of entombed papal goods in a bunch of empty apartments somewhere.
Yeah, they seal it off. Weird. Seal it off, and the pope just molders in there for the all of time. Interesting stuff though. I love seeing these rituals and stuff. Is there anything else we want to talk about in this episode?
No.
Well, that'll do it for the new Pope. We'll have a new Pope episode out next week, the same time, for your enjoyment. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Cecily.
See you later.